Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. Something of a return visit today. A few years ago, we had a nice program talking about entrepreneurship and economic development as scientists sort of get involved with this. And there were some ideas that came out of Lamar University, which have now come to fruition in a rather roundabout manner, but it's just fascinating and something I think we should know about. So, Russ, who's our guest again?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Dr. David Koch, who's the Associate Director and the Gill Chair of the Innovation and Commercialization Center of the College of Engineering of Lamar University. Welcome to Science Studio, David.
Thank you, Russ. I'm very glad to be here.
Yeah, we had you about 2 or 3 years ago in one of these programs with one of your colleagues. And just refresh us. We don't want to go through your background. We know you're a chemist that, you know, became a bit of an engineer and so forth. Just remind us what this Center for Innovation and Commercialization, what was the idea and what has happened in the last 3 years?
Well, there is a trend across the United States of making universities pay their way. They're losing a lot of state support. And so there is a general consensus that universities should get more involved in commercialization of their technologies. There's about 2,000 of those activities going on across the United States. And we have a very good engineering college, and we thought we'd be involved in it as well. Universities are notorious about having difficulty commercializing their technology.
And so then from the idea that you had of having this center, you've now got it up running with substantial funding. Why don't you go through that story of how the funding materialized?
Glad to do so. The Economic Development Administration has six regional activities across the United States, and we're in one that covers Texas, Louisiana, and so forth. And we wrote a proposal to initiate this program, and we got, with matching and so forth, we got about $1 million to start that 3 years ago, just after we had the interview here.
Success always comes from the sort of exposure you get on Science Studio.
So what we followed on that was the EDA came back to us and said, hey, you're doing quite well getting this started. Why don't you apply to this next program? It's to really make the center run for 5 years. So we did that, and we got $1 million from them, plus $1 million in matching. So there comes another $2 million in them. And about midstream there, we had the opportunity to build a building to house this activity from a program of reimbursing regions that have had quite a bit of devastation from hurricanes. And the Beaumont, Southeast Texas region qualified for that money, and we wrote a proposal. Had to have extremely good regional support. Seven counties had to get behind it and give up their desire to share that money. And so we accomplished that, and now the building will be in operation in about 18 months.
So the secret there is to get the sort of the general population and the political persons in counties to all come together.
Absolutely.
It sort of sounds like Whipside out here in Carlsbad. They went out and got public support to say, hey, bring in the nuclear depository, as opposed to letting the government place it somewhere against the wishes of the people.
Right. And we had to do quite a selling job. You know, each county had different issues that they would like to have used that money for. But I think they took the long-term view, and that's what we told them. Invest in the future. Don't use it now to repair a few destroyed infrastructure and some materials issues. Give us the money, and we'll make sure that the seven counties reap the benefit of what Lamar University and the region can do in new diversified economic activity.
So you're expecting then the commercialization to produce little spin-off companies that will hire people and provide jobs and the usual mantra that we hear coming out of
Correct.
DC.
Every university says that.
Yeah.
They're having quite a bit of degree of unsuccess, I would call it. It is quite difficult because, you know, when you're producing proprietary information at a university, it has to be protected.
Right.
University wants interest in it. And then, of course, you want to patent it. And universities are notorious for not having money to pay for patents.
Right.
And so...
So you have to find outside companies that have an interest in your product.
Right. In our activity, we're trying to develop a fund for patenting, somewhat independent of the university. There's a tremendous battle goes on in universities as to where resources go. And
right.
So...
Let me ask you to take back a step here because recently schools like Harvard and MIT, there was an article called University Incorporated, have taken this tact. And the question I have for you is talk a little bit more about how research deserves to do useful things for people and how the mindset is changing.
Well, I think the federal government has realized this. At least I know the state government did. We had representatives a few years ago come to Lamar University and tell us that if we wanted to continue state support, we'd better start doing something to create jobs and help the economy. So
that was an edict from the state of Texas to
Lamar
University.
An edict from the state of Texas, correct.
Create jobs for us.
To help create jobs
yeah.
In the sphere of influence of each university in the state. I think the university's got the message. Of course... The state set up some funds that universities could go after, and University of Texas El Paso has been quite successful. And I think Dr. Chianelli here has achieved one of the ones that have come out of a university to capture that money. So that's on the state level. Now on the national level, the same situation has been occurring since the crash or the economic turndown in 2008. It's all been about jobs, and so the federal government, each agency has been putting money out there, at least putting their calls for proposals to there that's somehow related to commercialization. And so you build strength across the nation when the universities start thinking about that, because a lot of great innovation occurs in universities that never goes commercial.
That's right. But that must mean at some stage that the individuals in the university who have previously been doing what Russell perhaps might call non-useful research, or at least not seeing the having the vision to see
right.
where it could be useful, I think that's
right.
probably a better way. But these are also the people that are teaching the next generation. And you know, it's very difficult to suddenly I'm not very happy with the concept of the University Inc., right? Russell and I have discussions about this. But you can't do just turning it on. I mean, you've got to then hire special people with responsibility in one part, but perhaps not in other parts, which means a bloating of the university in one sense. That creates jobs.
Sure. Well, in our proposals to the Economic Development Administration, we followed their lead, of course. To get money, you better write proposals that track exactly what they want, and they wanted a cultural shift at universities of the faculty. They wanted faculty to really think about the end use of what they're doing, even at the most fundamental level. And then that causes the faculty to begin to shift their view of what they're producing. I've written hundreds of papers.
Yeah.
And I can see that it takes 10 to 15 years a lot of times for basic, really basic research to get picked up and utilized, if at all. So having a generation of faculty that tie it immediately. In fact, in our center, we encourage faculty as soon as they have an idea that their research is useful, they come to us and we do pair them with a business student, and they do an economic study to see if it's worth pursuing on the economic side.
Let me touch on the educational side, too, because our president, Dr. Natalicio, has encouraged us to help local economic development. And one good example of this, and we do this here at UTEP, too, is Andy Barrow, who's at Rice, who has won a contest in the United States for student startups. And what you do is you get in a class and you get some business people together with chemists or whoever, and you let them work together and let them come up with ideas. And if the ideas are good enough, they create. But it's part of the educational process to teach some of the scientific people and engineers how to do it.
That's exactly right. In fact, in our chemical engineering department, our last faculty hire was a great, what we could perceive, a great young engineer working in the area of biomedical sensing, and he had taken the time to get an MBA. So there is a pairing of the business school and engineering in one of our faculty, and we're going to look for more of those folks.
So that's a new take on interdisciplinary education.
Absolutely. Educate them in both.
So do you see, I mean, I'm sort of talking to both of you here. Do you both foresee that in the future, people who want to, say, study chemistry or physics, you would like them to have a minor in business and entrepreneurship and at the same time and maybe drop some of the and then you go, what? What are you going to drop? Texas tells you 120 hours, young man, young lady, and you get a degree.
That's exactly right. But I think on the side of engineering where I'm presently at, we've traditionally been closer to commercialization than, say, a physics professor doing quantum optics or something. So I would think that you need both. And in rare instances, you have folks, and I think part of it is if the faculty has spent time in industry, they automatically have an appreciation of what they're doing, because if they didn't, they would have been fired from their jobs.
We'll come back to that after we take a short break, because that's a fascinating sort of an idea. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with sometime co-host Russell Chianelli and Dr. David Koch, who's the Associate Director of the Innovation and Commercialization Center at Lamar University in Beaumont, Texas. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Over the years on this program, we've teased each other about being follicularly challenged.
If a new treatment actually works in humans, maybe we'll both end up with a full head of hair.
I don't think even that could save you, Dave.
Ha! Speak for yourself. But seriously, this treatment could be better than today's drugs and hair transplants.
Right now, people take minoxidil. They also take finasteride, which stimulates hair regrowth by increasing testosterone. But as soon as the drug is stopped, hair loss returns.
Another approach is hair transplant, which moves hairs from an area of thick growth to the bald areas. The hairs are first separated out, then thousands of hairs are transplanted, requiring several sessions.
Most people attain 60% of new hair growth after 6 to 9 months. The drawback is the cost, ranging from $4,000 to $15,000.
This new treatment doesn't transplant hair. It cultures cells that grow new hair. Researchers cut out a small patch of scalp with abundant hair. They remove dermal papillae cells, grow them in culture, which then give rise to hair follicles.
They found in order for these cells to grow hair, they had to be cultured, suspended in droplets on the lid of a petri dish. The cultured cells were then injected into human foreskins grafted onto mice. Since human foreskins do not grow hair, they reasoned that if hair grew on that skin, it's likely to work on the scalp.
Sure enough, hairs sprouted from 5 of the 7 treated areas. But the hairs that grew are rather small and only express 22% of the genes normally turned on in hair follicles.
The next step is to turn on more genes so the cells grow more and better hair. Sadly, Dave, a lot of work remains before we can cure your chromedome.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, David Koch, who's the Associate Director of the Innovation and Commercialization Center at Lamar University. And we're talking about the need, and I like this one, for getting faculty out of what some people call the ivory tower, others think of as the sort of the pinnacle of being creative and thinking and setting society in new directions without the need to worry about the commercialization, the day-to-day living. Are there universities, are there locations where, you know, sabbaticals in Texas are like chicken's teeth, or what are they called? Hen's teeth. You don't get them very easily. But are there places where sabbaticals into industry is sort of a norm?
I don't think it's ever been a norm, but I think in the last few years, it's being realized. One of our sister universities, Texas State University in San Marcos, which is in our system, has actually implemented a program of faculty taking industrial sabbaticals.
Tell us about the book you wrote a few years back that talks about how you do theory that accelerates innovation in material science.
The name of the book is Materials by Design, and it was a concept that the Department of Energy, back in the mid-1980s, I think when we wrote the proposal in 1985 or 1984 and got it funded to a tune of about $700,000 to do a study and bring the world's leading experts together to see if it was possible at that time to design materials with specific functionality that was useful from basic experiments and basic information. And we brought the experts together, and the consensus was yes, but we're not there yet. Now we're something on the order of 30 years later, and this program has been reformulated by the federal government in what they call the materials genome. And so the book that we wrote said, yes, it was possible. We need a lot more money. Of course, people in universities always say that. A lot of research need to be done. But it was a start. And in fact, out of that book, you can see that those ideas have grown over the years, and they're actually appearing now in the calls for proposals. So it's a new world we have with better computers. Right. Researchers now, instead of having to go to a central computer center to do their research, now have...
Digit whip out your telephone.
they have that power right on their desktop.
Right.
And so now you have a generation of students that are not only doing experiments, they're also doing theory.
Yeah.
And with encouragement from their mentors, I think this might become a reality, this materials by design.
Let's just go to one point that I'm always intrigued by. Everything that you are talking about is sort of saying, look, the university has got to be this catalyst into new ideas that can be commercialized because, quote-unquote, they can be useful. But the thing that I was trying to get at is, as you pointed out, you had to go through a lot of effort and a very special circumstance, that is a hurricane, in order to get the funding to be able to put this together and start to work. And that took the government, the federal government in this case, through various of its agencies. Where's the industry? Where is the industry in this whole game? I see a lot of people mouthing that you've got to get more applied research, useful, help the people. And then you go to a company and say, hey, look, we'd like $200,000 to set this up. And they say, well, how does it apply exactly to product 24 on our list of products? And if it doesn't, they're not very interested. So give me a little bit of how successful have you been at getting American industry to buy in and give you money that is sort of not tethered to a particular goal they have for this week?
You know, that's a very good question, but it's fully loaded with all kind of problems.
Oh, absolutely.
the local industry, of which we have a good relationship, that is Lamar University. We have 30 major refineries and petrochemical companies there, and they all come together on a regular basis to support the university. Unfortunately, they come together always with moral support, and they're quite willing to give you letters of recommendation and so on, but they're rather slow in coming forward with money unless it's in their best interest.
Exactly.
Now, according to our dean of engineering, which I have great respect for, he said you'll only get industry interested when you can solve a problem for them.
Yes.
We got great support from industry over the years when we were solving their emission and environmental problems. Now, when we're trying to do startups and commercialization, it's a new ballgame with industry.
Well, there's a big difference between a startup and an existing large industry.
Well, existing large industry is rather sluggish in decision making. It's always the bottom line. I can tell you one university's been very successful with industry, and that's Rice University.
Yep.
They created the Rice Alliance. They're now the world's best.
That's Andrew Barron.
They're the world's best business competition, and they get tremendous support out of industry. But you have to realize they're sitting at the back door or front door of many corporate headquarters where they can have direct access to.
Well, that's exactly right. And then, of course, just to finish this little area, it comes to the whole concept of utility and useful. And that can be extraordinarily short-term.
Exactly.
Just you're looking in the mirror and you've got a spot on your face, and that's the most important thing you're going to carry around for the rest of the day. And so, you know, that's where I have
Well, if
some
you
issues.
Have a spot on your face, David, who has his own company here, has a cure for it.
That's good.
Because he's also got a health startup, and I'd like to take a little bit of time for him to tell us about that.
Great.
Well, I have to do a little bit of a background because I was trained as an inorganic physical chemist that was very applied on the pragmatic side of applications, and that was great. So that qualified me to be a chemical engineer. And I thought I was doing the world a great favor by publishing hundreds of papers and so forth until a friend of mine came down with a fatal disease, given 2 years to live, and I felt helpless to help. And so what I did is I started studying biochemistry to help that person, to help manage the health care that was going to be provided. And along the way, I began looking at the mechanisms of healing within the body, and we conceived a way of speeding wound healing, and we were successful. There's five major stages of wound healing. The first, if anybody has ever been wounded, the immediate thing you see is blood, and you have to stop the bleeding. That's called hemostasis. The material that we make immediately stops the blood flow. That prevents the vascular constriction at the wound site so tissue doesn't die. And then the next thing is everybody knows the wound gets inflamed, which we call inflammation. Our product totally jumps that step of wound healing and goes to granulation and closure of the wound. That is, the skin starts to try to grow back over it.
This is one product.
This is one product that accelerates.
The initial point and the second.
Right. It accelerates wound healing by accelerating four out of the five steps and shuts down the bad one, which is inflammation.
And this is just one material.
This is one
material. Can we disclose this on the air?
What's the name of the product?
The name of the product is called Fast Forward.
Fast Forward. I love it.
It's being,
that's great.
It's being produced by Stage One. That's our company. And we're in the process of writing our first patent on it.
Oh, so it's still proprietary.
It is still
proprietary. But it's called Fast Forward, and the company is Stage One. I just love this. Okay.
Right.
So this came about because of your – well, you're a chemist, inorganic physical chemist, so you had to have a collaborative team. Let's go back to this interdisciplinary
Well, this is not something that I really worked on at the university. This was all caused by a personal tragedy that I was facing. And my study at night, which said, look, I have to do something to stop the progression of this disease. And I think that's one of the great things that's happening here at UTEP. Professor Chianelli has developed several, I think, promising cures for various things that are going on in the human body. So it doesn't take an MD. It takes a scientist looking at...
Well, but you do have to have a collaboration with people in the biomedical field. I mean, Russ's work, I think, the Maya Blue, that we're supposed to stop colon cancer. But you need people over there in biological sciences who know what they're doing.
Right. Currently, our material is being tested for its toxic effects on sales. So its cytotoxicity is being checked right now.
Okay, so how far are you away then from really commercialization? Because I gather, you know, what is this called, the valley of death that you people
talk
about?
Well, we're right now just test marketing it for pets.
Oh, okay. So it's a different – that's interesting.
Which
so,
doesn't require FDA intervention.
But that's – so it's interesting. So the whole regulatory process for animals is much more lax, if I can say it that way, than
yes.
it is for humans.
Yes. And
that's a clever dodge.
No, I guarantee you that there are rules that if you start practicing on your dogs that the federal government will come in. But also talk a little bit – you often talk about sulfur and how important that is in your body chemistry.
Oh. Okay, Russ, you asking me about one of my passions, and that's sulfur. I got my Ph.D. studying high-temperature sulfides and chalcogenides. I went to Germany to work on, at the atomic level, sulfurization catalysts, where we could visualize single atoms. And then I proceeded from 3 years in Germany to an industry where we produced desulfurization catalysts.
Right.
And I ran a large group studying desulfurization for about 8 years. Coming out of that, I continued to work on desulfurization catalysts for some years on a more fundamental level. And then only when I started studying biochemistry did I realize the ultimate importance of sulfur in the human body. It starts with the origin of life, and it's ending now with the maintenance of our health and our well-being. 1% of the body is sulfur, and 1% of a bacteria is sulfur. And so sulfur is intimately involved in almost every process in the human body. And so, yes, I'm passionate about sulfur.
So what was the point of the question, though?
Well, the point of the question was really that you have this, you know, interest, originally a materials person, Union Oil Products, who went down this alley of trying to understand and help people through your biology and biochemistry that you're learning. And I think
so it's
to
the
me,
journey which is important.
The journey,
which
yeah.
I think for the listener, that I mean, you start over here, and you've got no idea. You've got an initial trajectory, and then it's your imagination, your nose, your inquisitiveness that leads you, and now you've got this fast forward material. I mean, that's quite impressive.
Well, it's very important, I think, for the human to take charge of their own well-being. And unfortunately, a lot of our citizens don't have the background to do that. I'm lucky in that I've been in science for many, many years, and I have this scientific curiosity
yeah.
that says not only, look, I've got this problem, now immediately how am I going to solve that problem with very basic science.
So David Koch, the Associate Director of the Innovation and Commercialization Center, Lamar University, it's absolutely been a pleasure talking to you today. And we hope you come back in 3 more years and tell us how fast forward is forwarded fast, okay?
Well, I appreciate that, and I hope you're using it at that time.
And I would like to thank our director, Norma Martinez.
And we hope you'll come and listen to us again next week on Science Studio.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. El Paso's Biomedical Institute of the Americas, also known as Red Sky, is looking to hire a brand and digital marketing manager. Red Sky is a new company formed in 2012 by the Medical Center of the Americas Foundation. It has ambitions to be known globally as a premier innovation partner for healthcare inventors and innovators. Read more at mcasynapse.org.